This special episode of the Wired UK podcast is brought to you by Braintree V.0, the snippet of code that allows you to accept PayPal, Apple Pay, and credit and debit cards in your mobile Apple website, all with a single integration. To learn more and to try out the sandbox, go to BraintreePayments.com now. Coming up today, a special episode in which Wired's Ollie Franklin Wallace chats to Danny Boyle about his new movie, Steve Jobs. Ollie, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So you spoke to Danny Boyle last week. How did you find the conversation? Obviously, we're going to play it in full, but what were your impressions?
It was a really interesting conversation. Obviously, Steve Jobs is a very Wired movie as a character who we all know and I was going to say love, but that's a bit weird.
Admire, exactly. Respect, think about, feature in our lives.
Exactly. And it's a very interesting movie. I recommend you all go and see it. It's not what you probably expect when you think Steve Jobs. If you've read the Walter Isaacson book about Steve Jobs' life, this is not that, although it is ostensibly inspired by that book. The writer Aaron Sorkin, with whom we have an interview on Wired.co.uk this week, has taken a few liberties with Jobs' life, but also spoken to some people who Isaacson didn't speak to, and the result is a very different kind of view of Steve Jobs' life than maybe you're expecting.
This is kind of a Shakespearean take on the life of Steve Jobs, to take a few key facts and then fit them into what is essentially a dramatic narrative rather than a realistic portrayal of events.
Yeah, I think that's right, and I also think that fans of Aaron Sorkin's other shows like The West Wing will know that in a lot of his films and his TV series, he kind of uses characters as a mouthpiece to discuss kind of broader concepts. And so Steve Jobs, the film, is also about Silicon Valley more broadly. It's about disruptive technology, and it's also very much about the nature of genius and whether you need to be this kind of control freak, like super obsessive madman in order to produce greatness, or whether there's another way.
The whole conversation will now follow. It's about 25 minutes long. But thanks for joining us on this special issue, and thanks for joining us, Ollie Franklin Wallace.
That's my pleasure.
I can't put it more simply than this. We need to put our resources into updating the Apple II.
By taking resources from the Mac.
It's failing. That's a fact.
It's overpriced.
There's no evidence that it's...
I'm the evidence! I'm the world's leading expert in the Mac, John. What's your resume?
You're issuing contradictory instructions, you're insubordinate, you make people miserable, our top engineers are fleeing to Sun, Dell, HP, Wall Street doesn't know who's driving the bus, we've lost hundreds of millions in value, and I'm the CEO of Apple, Steve, that's my resume.
But before that, you sold carbonated sugar water, right?
On the very small off chance that our readers do not yet know anything about the Steve Jobs film, it is a biopic, but it's also not a biopic. Can you tell us a little bit about that conceit and why you chose to go with such an unusual take on this man who's so central to the Wired world?
He is, isn't he? I've tried for a while now to stop people using the word biopic, but I've stopped trying to stop people using the word biopic because it's pointless, because it's clearly a kind of a very quick way for people to understand that, oh, it's a real life story, is it? The difference, I think, is it's not cradle to grave. That was the big thing. And the innovation in it is it uses three of the launches. Because he revolutionised is an overused word, but he really did revolutionise like half a dozen different industries, one of which was, or invented, product launches. And so and that's what a lot of people, I think, visually know him from. The walking backward and forward with the microphone, or, you know, with the clicker and... that kind of image, everybody has that in their brain. So what's clever about the script is that it takes three of those and just stops just before he walks on stage. So it's literally, metaphorically saying it's behind the scenes. No, it's literally and metaphorically saying it's behind the scenes in the 40 minutes before he walks out on stage, real time, three times, all with the same bunch of people. So it's repetitive, almost like a fugue, really, except it's growing. There are depth charges. That's all we always like to think of it, being laid in this repetition of these meetings with the people who matter to him professionally or personally. And they begin to resonate, they begin to kind of detonate or whatever as they go on, and he begins to be... And conversely, as he achieves everything he wants to, because the initial launches are not successful, the Macintosh was not a success initially, the next disappeared, it was a big failure. And when he finally gets where he wants to do with the iMac, of course, But on a personal level, he's come apart, literally. He's been taken apart by the people who love him. in the quest of finding some kind of personal resolution with his daughter, you know.
I want to talk a little bit about that structure, and it is really, we do see the progression of, it's not really until the very end of the film that Steve is the Steve Jobs that we kind of know, and, you know, with the turtleneck and the presentation style that we're used to. I'm interested if you've ever thought about your kind of development and what three films, just these three product launches, are there three films where you think that you became Danny Boyle? Like, do you see that in your own career, that kind of formational stage?
It's interesting. You'd have to include the first one, because I have this theory, your first film is always your best film. It may not be your most successful film, it may not be your technically most proficient film, but it's always your best film, because you don't know what you're doing. You really do, even if you think you know what you're doing, which is important to persuade some people that you do know what you're doing or think you know what you're doing, you don't know what you're doing. And there's an innocence about them that is amazing, actually. And I see that in, you know, I always say the Coen Brothers film, you know, they're geniuses, but their best film is still Blood Simple. Because, you know, there's a kind of wide-eyed naivety in it that it's just, you can never get again. And you never, it's like learning language. Once you've learned it, you're picking up all sorts of other stuff as you learn it. So you learn stuff and then you're trying to, so I would include that. That would be one, I think. What would be the others? I've obviously have to include Jobs, obviously, for promotional reasons. But I'd put Millions in there as well, actually, because Millions is one that people don't know very well and is about mothers and sons, whereas the Jobs film is about fathers and daughters, I think. So that is a neat way around your question.
It reminded me of another film this year, which is Whiplash, in that it really explores kind of the psychology of what makes great men or what makes great individuals into who they are. And I wondered if you had kind of, in your studying of him and his life, what you kind of felt that psychology that everyone knows about Steve Jobs of, you know, he was a bit of a jerk to people and he was, you know, he pushed everyone to the limits. But in doing so, he, as you say, transformed a lot of industries. So I wonder how that's kind of resonated with you and whether you think that that's kind of true.
Well, the kind of one of the arguments that runs through the film, which was expressed, is that it's possible to be decent and gifted at the same time. I think the truth, and I personally would ascribe to that as a moral philosophy. The truth is, I think there's no prescription you can make, really. And I think behaviour is often, most often, clearly an expression of psychology. And his was, I mean, and we show this very clear, it's very sophisticatedly shown, sort of backwards, but it's clearly evident that his psychology was primarily formed or forged by his adoption. And although, and he acknowledges in the Isaacson book that the film's based on, that he had the most amazing parents, Paul and Clara Jobs, who adopted him, were perfect. And yet he didn't seem able, and many people testify to this, that he was unable to forget that initial, the fact that he was put up for adoption. And in some way you can read that the way that he treats his daughter, is he instead of learning from that and avoiding that, he almost magnifies it in his behaviour towards her so that she goes through the same as him, really, in a way. And he clearly felt, I think, that you have to suffer. You have to go through sufferance to actually achieve, you know, to find a purity, really. If you wrote that as a fiction, you go, oh, it's a bit cheap psychology, isn't it? It's a bit easy. Mm-hmm. But we never found anything that contradicted that, you know, other than, I mean, that's what it seems to, that was the path lane that he laid for himself and for others who he insisted on taking on that journey with him, you know.
Do you see something, I was interested that this film and Steve Jobs is venerated for his approach to business. And he's, you know, the subject of MBAs, and people kind of want to live their lives and run their businesses like him. Do you see this film as potentially having the same impact as Wall Street when it came out? You know, when Wall Street came out, everyone said, "Greed is good," and yet, for some reason, it made lots of kids want to be bankers. Even though that wasn't the moral message. So I'm interested do you see this kind of veneration of him as a good thing or potentially destructive?
I think the veneration of him will continue. I've been surprised at how his legacy or appears to be increasing in a way since his passing. You would imagine it would diminish somewhat, but it hasn't. It doesn't appear to be. And his company appear to be being judged, you know, in comparison to what, you know, it's a constant comparison, what would Steve have thought? So it appears to be, it's an indelible mark he's left. I think he represents, I mean, he's particularly, in America, he represents the frontier man. That's OVC business. It's constant frontiermanship, you know, bravery, going out there on your own, that feeling of... Mm. And the, although the product launches were clearly designed to be feeler-friendly, they're also the lone frontiersman, aren't they? I mean, he's out there on his own, this big stage, with nothing, less and less furniture, because you could see he hid behind a podium at the beginning, nervous, and then he got rid of the podium, and he got rid of the notes, and he's just out there. And that's the lone frontiersman, I think, you know, forging a path, and that's how the American business, I think that's how the American business model romantically views itself, clearly, and he's enhanced that, or... So I don't think it'll have the same impact as Wall Street. It's not really about that, is it? It's more psychological, I think. It's the sound of his mind is how I always thought of it. Some of that is business orientated. Remarkably, and this was supposedly true as well, in certainly the people we spoke to, he was not interested in money. He didn't seem to be driven by money at all. It was this idea of the interrelatedness of computers and humans. That was which we've achieved. Well, I mean, and if biotech continues, we literally will achieve it. That's what he was interested in more than anything. And he, it was interesting, he never had any security around him, despite being worth billions. You know, he never had any, there was no security around his house, anything like that. He didn't have any of the trappings like that at all. He had a jet, I think, for a while. But that was it, really. And that was just clearly in terms of made sense, you know. The money didn't matter, really, certainly to them at that level. But
it's visually really striking. And one of the things that you notice throughout the film is that you film the first act, I think, in 16mm, and then the second act is 35mm film. And then the final act is in modern-day digital. Can you talk a little bit about that kind of visual choice and what you think it brings to the film technologically?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is real geek, Phil, but we loved it. Because there's a big... I don't know how aware of it you are. There's a big argument at the moment about, is film going to die out? And there's certain big-time directors, Chris Nolan, Spielberg, who are trying to... Quentin Tarantino. Trying to kind of remain on film. And even used even more sophisticated... You know, 70mm. And so it was wonderful to actually. We decided early on that we would make the three sections as different as possible, and the feel of the actors, the look of the spaces themselves. Because originally, the first launch, the Macintosh, was the place where they launched the iMac. They went back to the Flint Auditorium in Cupertino. And they've been back there a number of times. They launched the iPhone 6 there, for instance. But we decided to make them three different spaces, so it felt like you were seeing, we were enhancing the differences. And then at each place, we tried to emphasise, through the stock, the format we shot on, we tried to emphasise their individuality. So the Flint Auditorium is a passable, it's a Wooker theatre, really. It's quite simple. It's got this amazing spread of seats that we use at the beginning. But apart from that, it's undistinguished, really, theatre. And we thought 16 mil, he's already worth 400 million, but he saw himself as a punk, really, as a rebel. You know, the IBM film, the 1984 film, is the heroic rebel refusing to join conformity, refusing to be trapped by... the overbearing company, and we thought that it'll 16 mil will be perfect for that. It feels homemade. It's rough around the edges. There was a byproduct is it slightly disguises the actor's age because we cast them all to be 40, you know, roughly at the end in the third part. In the first part, they're meant to be in their mid-20s, so it softens. They were all very keen on that. That was very popular. It's very weird shooting on it again because you get hairs in the gate. All that kind of ritual of film, which you'd forgotten, which is you have to check the gate. You can only do 10-minute takes. But it felt rough and ready, and that was good for the early part of it. And the early part also includes the garage where they, which all does feel very, very early days. The second part then is set in the Opera House. We moved to the Opera House in, because it's a very, of all the stories, it's the most theatrical story because it's got a hidden, we used to call it the subterranean river of intention runs through it that nobody can understand. Joanna's constantly trying to find out what it is. And of course it's revenge. I mean, that's manipulated by Aaron, obviously. I don't think he set out to make the next computer fail.
This is the next launch that you're...
Yeah, the next launch. Yeah. And it's a significant computer for... The OS that was in it is actually still, supposedly, remains now. Parts of it remain now in the OS that Apple used. Avi Tabanian developed that. But obviously, we reverse engineer the idea that it's a Trojan horse by which he wins back control of Apple, where he's been ousted from. And you see him being ousted, and quite who you believe about how he was ousted is part of the intention of the scene. Mm. So that was set in the opera house because it almost felt like an opera, like a revenge opera. And the music is designed to do that as well. And the auditorium is ornate. It's a Beaux-Arts theatre from 1932, I think, and it's, which is old, and when, as American goes, that's quite old. And it's gilded, it's gold, and, you know, red velvet. And 35 is the most liquid, the most beautiful of all our formats, really, and felt great for that kind of storytelling. So we used that. And then the big change that we made was that we used digital in the final part, 1998, the launch of the iMac. Now, digital hadn't arrived in the film world by then, not our part of the film world. It wasn't used in storytelling until much later. But we used it because he'd already arrived at digital, because the company he'd literally funded with his own money, Pixar, released Toy Story in 1996. And I remember sitting in Leicester Square with my children, and they were wee then, they were little then, and I went along thinking, oh, this will be, you know, it's just like a Sunday morning, industry screening, I'll have a Dole's, whatever, some of it will be fun. Being blown away that the world had changed, I thought nothing's going to be the same again, ever. I mean, it didn't quite turn out like that, but certainly animation was never the same again. And so in respect of Steve and his vision, you want that third part to be, he's achieved everything he wanted to do, the clean lines, the beauty, the austerity of the fusion of art and technology had arrived. This was it, perfect.
It's interesting that you mentioned Pixar, and you know, a lot of people have talked about the missions from the film, and people, there was a big thing about accuracy of the film. You know, we've already talked a little bit about the biopic, and it struck me that watching the film, you could almost take away Steve Jobs and Apple and show the and take away the characters' names, and it would still be just as powerful. You know, it's almost like allegorical in this tale of this, you know, this guy who has a vision, is obsessed. Yes. With achieving it and driving away all his friends. I wondered what you kind of thought about that. It's almost like, it's almost not the Steve Jobs story in the same way that it is.
Yes, it is. I think it's, we always used to say it's kind of his approach, Sorkin's approach in a way is Shakespearean, which is that you take some useful facts and the rest is not guesswork, but it is a speculation, really, in order to illustrate certain ideas, which is about all of us, really, things we recognise. I mean, there is a useful thing as well about, which is that you, because obviously the Apple or our image of him, which is created by Apple, really, is an icon. He's already joined those figures that you see at the end of the film, the Picassos and the Martha Grahams and the great innovators, the great frontier men who pushed the boundaries back. He's already joined them. And of course, what you want dramatists to do is you pull them down from there. And I don't mean that in a derogatory way. I mean that you humanise them. You literally put them back on the ground and you find out the flaws, where the genius comes from. Mm. You try and give a sense of how they got there, what was involved, what were the costs of getting there. That's the idea of it, really. And the fatal flaw, Shakespearean, the fatal flaw. And in this case, it's, as he admits himself, it's amazing. He says, no, I mean, he has arrived at the perfect product. And at the time, the iMac was the perfect product. It was cool, it was sexy, it broke all the barriers, it brought the internet into the home. Suddenly, it was something that you were proud to own. It was like a badge. I've got one. I remember it, you know? So he's made the perfect, but he is himself poorly made. I mean, it's like classic Shakespeare stuff, I think. Anyway.
Talk to me a little bit about your relationship with technology, which I'm sure changed during the very high-profile Sony hack. A lot of information about this film came to light, which I'm sure you're probably tired of talking about. But how's that changed your approach to technology? Even if just how you send emails now.
Oh, my God. I mean, fortunately, I don't tend to send the kind of bitchy emails. I never had it. I don't know why. It was just happenstance. I never really engaged in the bitchy emails. But lots of people did. And it was fun reading them. They all changed.
Are you kind of thinking that? I'm like, oh, God, you must think, oh, I've got to go through my sent messages.
No, I didn't go through them all. Because I generally, I was just, it's, as I said, it was just, I was lucky that I didn't used to be like that. Could easily have been, but I never used to join in that kind of what was a ritual, really, of kind of like catty emails, I suppose. But yes, there were plenty of those exposed, and they've changed since the way people communicate now. It's all phone calls. It's gone back to phone calls. It's all phone calls. Nobody leaves messages either. It's live phone calls. Not that they can't be hacked. Of course they can be. Everything can be. No, it was curious, really, that we were dealing with this technology giant. And here we were in the middle of a maelstrom. And it was, my memory of it is that when it happened, we were casting at the time. We were casting actors generally. So we were, and the girls in the office, in the casting office, were very upset. That's my memory of it. Because although we laugh at it now, and it was funny, there was death threats and all sorts going. There was all these rumours about. Yeah. And it was, for the girls in the office, it wasn't very... That was very, I was quite shocked by that. They were very, very upset, you know. In terms of the film, I remember thinking, this is noise. It's the usual thing with Hollywood. It's of a particularly intense variation at the moment, but it's the same Hollywood noise, and to try and ignore it as much as we could.
We've got some quick-fire questions from the Wired UK Twitter following very shortly. But before that, I want to talk about how, you know, you spent a lot of time thinking about technology in the process of this film. You've made some comments about how you feel about companies and their use of data. We were talking about it before we started recording. And I wondered if how you feel. Are you a technology optimist or a pessimist? And how does a company like Apple and these huge Silicon Valley companies, who are kind of... They're kind of like a huge part of the world now. They're bigger than companies. They're almost kind of icons. They're bigger than governments. And I wonder how that makes you feel. Are you still an optimist, or are you worried about some of these things?
I'm kind of an optimist about everything except success, which I'm very suspicious of. I think that's a very healthy balance. I'm a pessimist about success once it's actually happened. And they are successful. My God. And there are inherent dangers in it, which are obvious, I think. And every day that passes by, you get examples of, you think, whoa, how's that going? I think it's the scale. I think it's the speed of change. The scale, obviously, is obvious. Like, these are the biggest companies in the world now. They're outstripping banks and pharmaceutical companies and oil companies.
Oil companies.
Yeah, it's just unthinkable, isn't it? And yet they're benign. They have this, by virtue of their virtue signalling, they are kind of apparently good for us.
Because that's the creation myth.
But yeah, they don't pay taxes, but they're good for us. I mean, it's like, well, we can't pay taxes because, you know. Anyway.
Because governments are old-fashioned, they need to be disrupted.
Governments are slow.
Yeah.
The law is slow, and these companies are so quick now. The speed of thought, the speed of mind, and because it doesn't involve necessarily the years in setting up a factory. Because it's all thought process, if you like, putting together existing things in a much more interesting way for people. It can happen so quickly. And you look at the rise of Uber, it's just like, that's astonishing. I mean, that's just not possible, is it? And maybe it is a bubble, but it's disrupting social life enormously and frightening local governments who don't know whether to resist change or to go with change. So it throws up huge questions, and I think this kind of film that looks at the origin, I mean, it's not really about that, these films, but it looks at the origins of these are really fundamental. And I always keep quoting, and I'm trying to make people read the Dave Eggers book, The Circle, because I was just reading it when this script arrived, actually. And I wasn't reading it because I wanted to make a film about it. I was reading it just because I love his writing. And that's a great book because he tries to kind of imagine 5-10 years down the line, but it's still reachable. It's not sci-fi, and some of the things in there are very interesting. When the benign becomes less benign, you know.
any listeners who haven't read Dave Eggers' The Circle, go and pick up a copy. Danny Boyle approved.
Absolutely.
We've got three last quick questions. We've been asking the Wired audience for their questions, so I'm going to do some quick fires. This is from at James Moran. Click wheel or touch screen?
I had a click wheel. I've got a click wheel. And my daughter bought me an iPod a long, long time ago, and it's still working. It's over 10 years old now.
Wow.
And it's a click wheel.
Well made, those.
Yeah, they were, clearly. And a lot of memory as well.
From Lucy Crew, were you an Apple fanboy before making the film? And I'm going to add on, are you now? Are you still using Apple products?
I do use Apple products. And I think one of the things that's interesting, and you think about a lot of stuff when you make a film like this. What was interesting was discovering that the arty community, by which I mean the media, filmmakers, all of us, we were the Trojan horse by which Steve Jobs introduced his overpriced products and persuaded, without hiring us as advertisers, we persuaded everybody else. Do you remember? These are so cool. Why are you using that rubbish? Who's this? We were advertising for him. How conscious of it he was, I don't know. But they did set up those PC versus Apple ads, didn't they?
Mm.
You know, so versus Mac ads. So, I don't know. I try not to be, but clearly I'm a user. A user means one thing, you know? I mean, I'm addicted.
Last question from Lawrence Lundy. Do you have any plans to use VR, and do you think that VR is the next cinema medium?
I must talk about this, just briefly. I didn't really have much experience of it other than Flashbang Wallop. And my daughter runs this festival in the East End called Shuffle. And she did this thing with Chris Milk's films, who's a filmmaker from America and made a couple of films. And she set up a virtual reality experience, which is also touchy-feely as well. It was called The Feelies. And it was part of the community festival that she runs and I'm involved in with a number of other people. And I was amazed at it because I was very shocked at how properly emotional. One of his films was set in a Syrian refugee camp in Jordan, and it's a very good refugee camp. It's not images that you might think of appalling suffering. It's very well organised, very clean. And yet the film, because it was honest and let people talk for themselves and just observe their lives, you know, the lads playing football, and it was very moving. And it was moving, I knew I wasn't there, and yet it took me there more than I thought it could ever be, than it ever might do, really. I thought it was going to be a technology trick. And yet my mind said, no, forget that, you are there. For storytelling reasons, you're involved now. You know, it's kind of, it includes you. And I was very moved by it. So I think it will, I was very surprised and very moved by it, yeah.
Do you think it's the future?
I don't know. I think it certainly play part of the future for those of us who, I regret that it's no longer a communal experience. I love cinema, which is very involving in that way. And but it remains communal, even though you don't react with the people necessarily. You don't interact with the people, but it's a communal experience. But the loneliness by which we now live our lives through technology suggests it will be, yeah.
Interesting. Danny Boyle, thank you for joining us on the Wired.co.uk podcast. Steve Jobs out on the 13th of November, and it is fantastic. I do suggest you all go and see it. Thank you so much for joining us, sir.
Thank you very much.